Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned, and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. On the show today, I'm delighted to be interviewing Graham Hobson. He is a CTO and entrepreneur and was the founder of Photobox, Europe's largest personalized printing company, and also the owner of the infamous Moonpig.com. Since the sale of the Photobox Group in 2016, Graham has worked with many startups and social impact companies on their growth and exit planning. Graham's just a truly brilliant wealth of information on business and life success. I really love his attitude towards sustained and steady growth. He's constantly focusing on how to keep edging the needle forward rather than looking for just quick wins. And Graham is a lovely human, and it was great to have his time on the podcast, and I hope you learn as much from him as I just did. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast and my interview with Graham Hobson.
Well, thanks, Sam. I'm pleased to be here.
So I just wanted to find out more about you. Being in the job, made you want to just not work for other people, or was it that you just saw the opportunities?
I think there's a lot of serendipity to startups. You kind of have to be in the right place with the right people around you and the right opportunity and the right connections. And all of that came together for me in a way that felt very contrived, but it worked. So many different things that came together at once. The main thing was the motivation for doing it, which was, at the time I had two young boys. I've got three sons now, but I had two and they were aged 3 and 1. And this was 1999 and effectively pre-digital for photography. So we used to take lots and lots of photos of them on a film camera. And every couple of weeks, I'd go off to Boots with my roll of film and put it in for processing. And a couple of days later, I'd go and pick it up and bring it home. And we'd look through the photos. And it just felt like there was a kind of poor quality ratio, which was something to do with the medium. You know, you couldn't preview the pictures. But also, I was a terrible photographer. So out of every pack of photos, maybe 36, there were like 4 or 5 that were really good. And the rest were kind of meh or junk. And you don't want to tear up pictures of your kids. But I'm kind of like that. I like keeping the high value things and not the low value things. So I thought the best way to be more selective about what we print is to buy a digital camera. So I bought one in 99, started taking pictures, and they were really good pictures. But then I found there was no way to get print. Nothing online, nothing in the high street. In fact, the only option at the time was to use an inkjet printer at home, which was just so slow and painful. And every time you went to use it, the cartridges had dried up. So that wasn't an option. And I was thinking, this can't be that difficult, right? One of the machines to print photos is in the back of every chemist in the country. So these machines are very common. And effectively, what you need is a website and an order management system plugged into one of these machines. Three components: web, order management, and a printing machine. And I thought, I know how to build an order management system. I'm not too hot on websites, apart from kind of basic ones. So I thought, it can't be that difficult, and I want to get a print service. So that was the motivation. The other kind of serendipity points were the team I needed to assemble were available. That convinced a friend of mine to join me as a co-founder, although it took some convincing, and I think he said no 3 times. I found a guy who was willing to be our CFO, who happened to be my wife's cousin's boyfriend, but it turned out he had some experience with seed capital and in fact one NASDAQ listed company. So he was the perfect guy for the finance side of things. And whenever I used to go to my dentist, he said, oh, you work in technology, don't you? My cousin runs PC World. And he would always say this. So I phoned my dentist and said, does your cousin still run PC World? Because he could be really useful to me in marketing for this idea I've got. And to cut a long story short, he didn't. He'd left PC World, but his name was Colin Glass, and he turned out to have been very connected to the photography industry in the UK, and he joined us as chairman. So all these people fell into place. I think also at the time I was 35 and there was this perception, the dot-com boom was happening. The perception was all dot-com entrepreneurs are 23, wearing Converse, straight out of college. And the reality was, I think the average age of an entrepreneur at the time was 35. But it makes sense, right? You're at this midpoint in your career, in your working life, and you've accumulated knowledge and confidence and contacts. And probably a bit of restlessness of, is this really what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my working career? So it's a perfect jumping off point into something far more risky. So I was at that stage of thinking, I don't really want to work for investment bank for the next 15 years, even though it would have been a kind of safe career choice to do that. So I think all those things came together.
Yeah, that's interesting. So your friend who you offered a few times and turned you down, like, so he became the CEO. What was his skills and why did it take so long?
I was CEO for the first 6 years, but he joined effectively as COO at the time. He was my manager at UBS in a technology team, and he went on to work for Merrill Lynch. And the point where I was leaving UBS, I called him up and he got me a job at Merrill's. So he'd always been a kind of corporate guy, senior technologist, and he was a good friend of mine. And I just thought he has very complementary skills to me. He's very structured and organized and methodical and will worry about finances and contracts and suppliers and all the stuff that I wasn't very good at worrying about. I was kind of all over the place thinking, well, we need to build this tech and we need to have these partnerships and we need to have these cool features. So I was kind of focused around product, tech and biz dev. And I thought I'm really not good at all the other stuff. So I nagged Mark a few times and he said no. And again, I was lucky because he got fired. So he then said, okay, I'll come. To be fair, he was due to go out to be like head of tech in Hong Kong or something like that. And it's a very complicated thing for an investment bank to send somebody overseas to a new jurisdiction and move their family. And I think some glitch turned up in this and they just couldn't follow through and said, well, the job isn't there anymore for me. I'll come and join this startup thing, not really knowing what it was.
That's really funny. Yeah, it took me quite a long time to convince my current co-founder to get on board. Do you think that if he hadn't come on board, you would have still got to where you were, but through different routes?
I think I didn't have the confidence to go it alone. And I also found the whole startup thing completely overwhelming for several years. It was all consuming. And when I look back, I don't know how I got anything done. I think my wife said I was kind of largely missing for large parts of that. But I think because I was on the journey with somebody I trusted, that I was able to keep going back into work and following through. And there were many times when I thought it wasn't going to work out, and to have somebody that's in it with you makes a big difference. So if I didn't have a co-founder, I don't think it would have worked.
Really nice to hear. It's a hard one. I've done a few things by myself and it's much harder to keep motivation going. But then sometimes when you're with co-founders, it can be annoying when you don't see eye to eye or you want to do things differently. Did you ever have issues together with like making decisions or feeling like the other person was pushing in the wrong direction?
Not in a destructive way. Broadly, we were quite aligned on things, which actually is not always a good thing. When I look back, one of my biggest regrets in the first 6 years is that we went too slowly. And there were reasons for that. We had this kind of existential event within 6 months of starting, which was the NASDAQ market crashed and dot-com bubble burst. And suddenly B2C tech companies were just considered to be a waste of time and we couldn't attract any new investment. And we had to go into this small business hibernation mode and we went into this kind of cash preservation mode. And I think we were both very good at that and we both had our heads down for a long time. But neither of us was risky enough to kind of pop up and say, right, that's enough of that. Let's go out and raise some money or let's go much faster. We were both too conservative. In that way, the alignment was a bad thing. But often I would kind of come in and buzzing about all these things we could do. And Mark would look at me like I'm the stupidest person. But that was okay. That was healthy tension. And he needed to be the sensible one. And I needed to kind of take more product risks at times or biz dev risks. But overall, it worked really well because we were different enough to keep each other on our toes, but aligned enough to keep going in the right direction.
Yeah. So what would you say were some of like the biggest failures that you had?
There were plenty. But I think that event I talked about, which is within a couple of months of us starting, NASDAQ crashing, and the whole market turning against internet companies was a big problem for us because we'd always intended to raise more money about 6 months in. When you did a startup in year 2000, there was no AWS to host. So you had to like buy your own hardware and it was super expensive. We had to pay for everything. The print machine cost £140,000 and nobody would give us a bank loan or a credit agreement or a lease agreement. So we had to pay cash for that. So we burned through the $500,000 we'd raised pretty quickly. And then when we found that we couldn't raise money anymore, that was a really big issue. And I think that first big test of actually, do you want to continue or not? You know, the chances are this business is going to fail. That was a really big moment for us because I think we just decided we're not going to give up. We're going to keep battling through and just kind of take the rest of the day off, go and get some sleep, come back tomorrow and come up with a plan. And I think that approach to any big problem we faced over the years was the right one. Do you want to solve it or not? If you do, then just come in with, you know, 5 ideas and figure out which one is the best one. And so that resilience and just ability to kind of keep problem solving and work through the issue was something that served me really well. And actually, I've found that in some companies where I've been helping the entrepreneurs, that resilience hasn't existed. You know, the first or the second big problem they face, they kind of panic and don't work through it. And then everything goes horribly wrong. I've been kind of disappointed in some cases that they didn't have an abundance of resilience, because I think that's probably one of the biggest skills you need as an entrepreneur.
It's definitely something that I think I've learned from various like traveling and things. I think they're completely wrong. You have no idea how it'll work out, but it does. And you start to get like a bit more ability to just have faith in things. And there's a nice analogy of there's a man running away from a tiger and he gets to a cliff edge and he has to jump off it. Otherwise he's going to get eaten by the tiger. But as he's falling towards the rocks, he gets caught on like a tree and he's stuck now like halfway up without this cliff. And he's either going to fall to the rocks or go back up and get eaten by the tiger. And so like he calls out to God, like, help save me. And then he'd be like, just take a leap of faith. And he's like, is anyone else up there? And he's just like searching for someone else to kind of help him. And he won't just like take the leap of faith, basically. And it's sort of, you have to kind of trust in things, which is more about like, actually, you don't always know how things work out, but you kind of have to trust, which I heard yesterday and felt like I should say.
Yeah, I think you've got to take your inspiration where you can, but there's always a way out. I was listening to a TED talk recently where somebody was talking about mental health counseling, and they said one of the best techniques for counseling somebody who feels in despair, for example, is if you say to them, what are you going to do to solve this problem? Sometimes people are lost and they don't know how to solve the problem. But if you say to them, imagine the most caring and kind person in your life, and imagine that person's in the room with them, and you ask them what they think you should do to solve the problem, people often specify one or two possible solutions to their issue that they couldn't articulate themselves in their own voice. And so by changing your point of view or taking yourself outside of yourself, it's often possible to see a solution. And I'm not saying that my issues have been anything like despair, but it's often been necessary to kind of look at it from a different angle and say, well, I have to do something. So what am I going to do?
Yeah, that's really profound. I think like often the answers are within us, but just sort of changing your mindset or like the lens that you're viewing at it slightly. So it was after about 6 years that you then got to the point where you were taking on Moonpig and like acquiring them?
No, that was much later. So during these lean years of running a small business, even though that wasn't the plan, we survived, but it was slow growth. We weren't paying ourselves much. Mark and I had both given up these kind of lucrative banking careers, and it was kind of going on a bit long. And I got to the point where financially it wasn't really working anymore. I'd remortgaged my house. I'd sold my car. We weren't going on holidays. And one of my big things was I couldn't afford a decent coffee in the mornings when I got to work. To spend £2 on a coffee was just out of the question. And if I took my kids to the park at the weekends and they said, can we get hot chocolate or something? It's like, no, we can't do that. And it just got a bit tiring that after, at this point, 5 years in, I really felt pretty broke. And so I said to Mark, we've got to change gears now. We either have to kind of grow and go to the next level with this company, or we have to give up because I didn't sign up to run a small business. So we made a plan to do that. And the plan was go and raise some money, like actually float the company on AIM, which is a really small market in the UK, and use the money to go and acquire an European business and expand into Europe. So we had to do it the other way around. We went and found a small Swiss company that we wanted to acquire. There were only 7 people, but they were already serving 12 countries. And we agreed a deal with them and then said, we're going to do this AIM listing. And so this was happening towards the end of 2005. And we flew over to Geneva to do the due diligence on them, Mark and I. We couldn't afford advisors to do this for us. And at the end of the first day, I spotted a problem in their database. It looked like they'd never charged VAT on any of their orders. And when we challenged them on this, they said, well, we're Swiss, we don't have to charge VAT. But that didn't make any sense because, for example, they had German customers and they were printing in Germany for those customers. So it felt to me like VAT was going to creep in somewhere. And it turned out the next day that indeed they should have been charging VAT all along and they hadn't. And their liability was basically more than the company was worth. So the deal fell apart and we couldn't buy them. And we phoned up our nearest rivals in France, a company of a similar age and similar stage of the business, and said, should we put the two companies together and go and do that? And they said, well, we've got some VCs lined up from the US. Why don't we buy you and we'll raise VC money to do it? So that's what we did. Effectively, a French company called Photoways ended up technically buying Photobox in the UK, and that happened in early 2006.
But you still owned most of the company?
Yeah, because it was shares, right? So I ended up just owning shares in the new company, but there were two guys running the French business, and actually both of them moved on shortly after the deal happened. So Mark and I were kind of left running this pan-European company, albeit on a small scale, not really knowing what we were going to do. Plus, I had now teams in France, and I was thinking, I don't want to move to France, and I can't be on Eurostar every day, so what are we going to do? So we went to the VCs and said, we really need to hire a new CEO, and they went out and found this great guy called Stan, who joined us later that year in 2006. And I've got a feeling that Stan felt like he was joining for a couple of years, and he ended up staying with us for 10 years. And so at that point, I shifted to be the CTO of the company, and we had a professional, experienced CEO.
Yeah, it's funny recognizing things you can't do. I do like asking people about like hiring. So I guess you were quite involved in the hiring process besides the VCs. Like, what were the key questions that you asked people to work out who would be a good fit for the team besides just the CEO?
Oh, I'd love to say I had this, you know, whole philosophy and strategy around hiring, and I didn't. Although I think that my gut instincts kicked in at some point. First of all, when I started Photobox, even though I'd worked for the London Stock Exchange and these banks, I'd never actually run a team. I'd always been an individual contributor, as I was back in my school days, effectively a tech contractor. So management was a bit of a shock to me, having to deal with people. I think it was probably about 5 years before I fired somebody. And even then, I think he basically fired himself because he saw that I was having such a difficulty doing it. So I wasn't very strong on people management and definitely not on the techniques of hiring. I think it was kind of hit and miss at the beginning. We were so small and so impoverished that we would just basically hire anybody that came along that we could afford. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And we were effectively a high growth company over the years. And it felt like a balloon that was expanding. And some people would just fall off as it was growing, and some people would find a way to keep clinging on as it grew. We hired this lady called Helen, who came in as like our head of customer services, but she ended up doing about 10 different jobs in the company, and whatever we threw her at, she mastered it. And then we had other people where they were really, really good at the job we gave them to do, but as the company grew around them, they stayed stuck in that role and ended up getting layered and layered. And some people obviously didn't work out at all. So it was kind of hit and miss. But to go back to your question, I think towards the end, I learned that it's really important to hire on values. Like, I really don't care where somebody went to school or whether they have a degree or not. One of the best developers I ever hired was someone who was just didn't impress me during the interview. And as we were wrapping up, he mentioned some personal project he'd been working on and he showed it to me. And it was this amazing kind of map of the world of travel photos and EXIF data tagging, and it was just a really impressive, relevant project. And I hired him because I could just see the passion and the skills he put into this personal project, even though he was not as impressive as a candidate. But then hiring for values like somebody who's honest and flexible and a good communicator and empathic with customers and all this sort of stuff, that's far more important than their specific technical skills. And I think the questions I'd ask were always about the domain we'd want them to work in. And I would look, I guess, for a couple of things. Well, I'd look for them to demonstrate some skills that were relevant, obviously. I'd look to learn something from them during the interview. If they can't teach me something new in an hour, then that's a problem. And I think you said, what question would I ask them? I only had kind of one standard question, which was a boring thing. It's nothing to do with what they did, but it goes back to the take yourself outside of your own frame of reference. I would always ask somebody to say, if I talk to your manager, your current manager, what would they say as the most relevant areas for improvement for you? If you ask them to think of their manager's view of them and what could improve, they always come up with something that's relevant. It's a very difficult question to fake or to just lie and say, well, they would say I'm perfect in every way. Like, it's just not credible. So that one always worked because it did surface what they felt were their biggest areas for improvement.
I really like that. I'm going to use that, I think. And so then when she started growing much faster and had the CEO, it was like another 6 years, 10 years before you got round to acquiring Moonpig.
So what happened was we grew really quickly from that point. I had the most traumatic project of my life, which was I naively said, oh, well, I'll take our existing six small websites around Europe and I'll build one super website that does everything and give me, you know, 9 months and 12 people and it'll be there. And 2 years later, this kind of dog's dinner of a website turned up that was really slow and wasn't anything like what I'd promised, but we got it going. And so that was distracting. That took a couple of years to really lock in and another 6 months to kind of work out the bumps. But once we had that website in place, our growth was very rapid. We suddenly had a premium service that we could roll out all across Europe with a full product range and some quite good software tools to design more complex products. And we were growing quite rapidly into new countries with new product ranges and the revenue was going up. And I think in 2010, we had our first opportunity to sell the company. We had an approach from an overseas company that were interested in buying us. And it really felt like it was going to happen. And at the very last minute, it fell apart. And M&A is a really super complex thing. And anybody that tells you that a deal is 100% going to happen, it hasn't been through it before, because there are so many reasons why these things can fall apart. And when we were reflecting on why couldn't we sell the company in 2010, we came to the conclusion that we were a bit subscale, even though I think at the time we were maybe turning over like £90 million or something like that. We felt that we were kind of stuck in between two worlds. We were too large to be an SME, so there weren't hundreds of companies that could buy us, and yet we were too small to consider things like an IPO or a trade sale to a big tech company. We were in this middle ground and we were trying to figure out what the weaknesses in the business were. And we thought, well, we need to add revenue. We need to add profitability. We need to add another product that's not so aligned with photography and Christmas. And Moonpig was the answer, really. I knew Nick Jenkins for years. He'd done the card printing for us for years. We'd done some products for them and yeah, we'd worked together closely. And so teams got together to figure it out. And that deal ended up happening in 2011.
But yeah, so how do you go around buying a company for 120 million? And so did you get investors to sort of invest in you to invest in them? Or did you get a loan?
Yes, we had to go out and raise more VC money. So we did an equity raise. But I also think there was a debt element to it as well. I think at that point we were large enough and cash generative enough where we could raise venture debt. So that's effectively you're adding on a loan to the business where you have to pay down the interest every month and you have to abide by certain rules to make sure you don't increase the risk profile. But the good thing is you don't have to give away equity. So it's not dilutive. And as long as your company is cash generative and profitable, the debt eventually goes away and you're left with the purchase you made. So it was funded through equity and debt.
So it was a hard one to know what to do, isn't it? It took you guys 6 years to go back to kind of raising more money in the first place. In terms of how do you know how much to give away and things, especially for early entrepreneurs, you kind of feel like it's your baby and you don't want to give much of it away, but you get like so much more in terms of valuation if you do, but you don't know, like, should you just give away like 30%?
I guess I was naive, but it kind of worked out. I gave away a huge chunk of equity to Mark. We started the company where I had slightly more than him, but effectively I gave him founder's equity. And it was great that it worked out between us and had a happy ending. But I did reflect at one point, oh my God, what happens if Mark leaves and just decides this isn't for him? What happens to the equity? And it wasn't options and it wasn't investing. So I think that was something I wouldn't do the next time. But like I said, it worked out well. And I think if you have a true co-founder who's bringing a huge amount to the table or contributing to the idea or whatever, then it's justified to split the pie at the beginning. It's difficult. I've seen some websites, kind of like the pizza equity calculator or something like that, where you key in the contribution that everybody's making to the startup and it calculates what is a fair split. There are books written on the subject as well, but I think you've got to do what's fair. I've always been a kind of generous soul and not want to hoard too much on my own side. So I think people have to feel incentivized and they have to feel like they have as much at stake as you do. And it's very difficult to do if you've got like 90% of the equity and you've given away two lots of 5% to somebody else.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Very sort of analytical view, just focusing on what is the most important thing and having a relentless focus on your priorities. I did kind of wonder, in terms of the mission, before you first introduced like how you got into the business, because when you think about it now, like a photo printing company sounds like a business just for the sake of having a business. But like when you started it, actually, it sounds like, okay, you had a real problem with like your family photos and like these things just didn't exist. But so did you ever feel that you started to lose track of the mission later on when there wasn't such like a need as such as in businesses now exist that can print photos? Your mission is to be the best photo printing business kind of thing.
At the beginning, I just wanted the service. And when I bought the digital camera and figured out there was no way to get prints, more out of something to do on the tube every day going into work, I'd just write this business plan on my laptop of, hey, if I was going to build a print service, this is what it would look like. And this is how I'd build the tech and how I'd do the marketing and how I'd raise the money and how the investors would get a return. And I wrote this business plan and I kept expecting Fuji or Kodak or Agfa to launch a print service, right? These were the three biggest photo brands in the world, and I thought it's inevitable, right? Everybody's launching online businesses online every week. And if one of them had, I would have given up because I just wanted the print service. And when none of them did, I thought, well, I'm going to go ahead and launch this. So at the beginning, there was a real need. And I think to start with, we thought of it as a very technical thing. We were offering a print service. You know, we were printing photographic prints onto paper and shipping them in the post. And the customer was basically me. Like these were techie guys ordering online because that's the only people who were ordering online in year 2000. So the customer persona was somebody like me. And so I would write in my tone of voice the copy on the website and they would get it and they would buy. And then at some point, as the company matured, we realized that the product and the customer base were changing. It was becoming a very female focused product because typically at the time it was moms of kids that were kind of the memory keepers of the house. And we had to change our appeal and products to serve a more female audience at the time. And we also realized that whilst we were physically selling paper and card and ink, we were actually dealing in a very emotional business. And everybody would tell us, I ordered this photo book and I gave it to my grandfather and he cried when he got it and I cried. Or I had these pictures which I sent to my friend and it was very emotional for us. And the common thread was this emotional connection that the product was enabling. And we realized that was actually the core of our business. We were enabling these emotional connections between people. And the product could take many physical forms, but it had to have that emotional element to it, which Moonpig has as well. Moonpig, it had more of a humor element, but it was still an emotional connection. And every time we thought maybe we should be selling SD cards or accessories or something, we'd say, no, you know, like none of these things have that emotional element. So it was just easy to completely discount them. So even as the business got much bigger, it still remains true to that original idea. We were using imagery to share connection or to make connections between people and often share emotion or humor.
Thanks. Glad I asked. That's very interesting. It certainly kind of relates a lot to my own personal issues with my current business kind of thing of trying to create emotional connections between people.
I heard a lady talk in January this year at a conference when we were still allowed to go to conferences. April Dunford is her name, and she has this book called Obviously Awesome, and it's all about positioning of your business, not even what market do you operate in, but what kind of niche within the market. And one of the lessons I learned from her is always ask your customers what they value most about your product. And often it's not something what you expected to hear. You might think you've got this great feature, or, you know, this thing is great because of this plugin or whatever. And they said, none of that stuff's important. I love this product because it does this for me that nothing else does. Thinking back, that was one of those moments where we thought we were selling, you know, paper and card and a very kind of pragmatic, fast, efficient service. And what people told us was, we just made them happy or cry or, you know, feel connected to their loved ones. And that was something that we never, well, certainly I never designed into the product.
Yeah, it's a really good piece of advice. It's something I try and do as well. Cool. So one question I really enjoy asking people is, what's one of your earliest memories?
I was an only child. Now that I see my own three sons and how they interact with each other, I think if you don't have siblings, you kind of lose the ability to reinforce some of your memories. I remember that objectively, I had a kind of stable, happy childhood. But I also remember, like I said, you know, not fitting in for quite long periods of time and feeling a bit awkward and out of place. So it's a mixture. And you know, I didn't like school because it's this group environment. I can remember lots of things like holidays and interactions with my parents and going into my dad's office. But I think the fun started for me when I was around 14 and I discovered computers and I learned I could code. And I started selling software commercially when I was 15 years old. So that's kind of my fun memories. I'm sure if you prompt me with some particular theme, I could come up with a memory on it, but no one standout memory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a really interesting answer. I hadn't thought about the any child thing, but certainly it's in a lot of things I remember, probably because I've had conversations with my sister about stuff and it was kind of in my memory, but completely forgotten. And yeah, it's interesting. Okay. What's one of the kindest things someone has done for you?
I think in a business context, it's probably Stan, my CEO. Just as I said, he had every reason to be frustrated with me getting up to speed, and just him being very patient and almost kind of respectful of my founder status, even though I didn't expect that. He's one of my best friends now, and I just appreciated the way that he very gently coached me and supported me through my own rapid learning curve. So I think that was really kind of him. And I think if I'm being kind to other people, it's just about giving them time and my full focus and supporting them in any way I can.
Yeah, it's really nice as in when you don't necessarily have the skills directly, but someone has the faith to like help you find the skills and things and giving you the opportunities before you're quite ready for them is where the most growth occurs. So yeah, 100% down with that as an answer. Okay, thanks so much for all the time and being a super useful human and all this advice.
No problem, my pleasure.
Thanks so much for Graham appearing on the show. What a hero. But there is more coming from Graham. During his time growing the Photobox Group into the hugely successful business it became, Graham had a really big number of lessons, and perhaps the biggest lesson he had was to learn the growth mindset. And he says that it was taught to him by the CEO that they took on to help grow the company, and Graham admits that he felt regularly out of his depth growing the company from zero to a huge exit, which is just a very uncommon thing for many entrepreneurs. And he believes the main reason for his success was others' belief in him that he could learn new skills rapidly and for developing his own mindset. So next episode, we have a short 10-minute masterclass from Graham on mindsets that you really won't want to miss. I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. My goal for this podcast is to help make people happier and wiser. And I'm also working on a few other projects in the podcasting space to achieve the same thing. I run the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with a friend, where we read and discuss a great non-fiction book a week. We talk about things like philosophy, psychology, the economy, self-improvement, and business. Books such as The Black Swan, Anti-Fragile, Invisible Women, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's a great resource. Most recently, I've been building an app, Syncify. It's really to level up your podcast experience. You can connect with your friends in the app and listen to the same things. So you can listen live in real time with each other or create shared playlists and catch up at your own pace. You learn so much more by discussing ideas with friends. It's really silly to listen alone. You can also discover and share brilliant episodes with ease without having to try and recommend podcasts in different apps and just it all getting lost and confused. So it's also good for combating isolation and mental health. I personally find social media quite antisocial, and I just don't find
it easy to reach out to friends to chat for no real reason, but I do love doing things with other people, and listening to the same content means that I can naturally talk about the same things, and it just gives me that friend time without going out of my way. So I really hope that it can help you, and I just would love you to try out the beta version and help us build this, and obviously do invite your friends. It's all about friends. So you can find out more about Syncify app by going to syncifyapp.com. Thanks for listening.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.